Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins, hell bro. Show. They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz, Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black on, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coins, hell pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Early treatment. And I said, here is a doctor who's out there doing what we should all be doing. And he's putting his knowledge and his experience out there to the world to help other people and to ensure that we're going to be saving lives. Because as doctors, we are supposed to do no harm. So I believe in the concept of informed consent, and I believe that we should do no harm, and I think we should do our best to save lives. And Dr. McCullough has been at the forefront of this from the very beginning, from publishing one of the first documents on early treatment and being at the forefront pushing for an expanded protocol for COVID-19. He has been in the fight in the U.S., in the Senate, in congressional meetings. And he has been a champion for us all, and he's become a global phenomenon. So I was very inspired by what he was doing. And when I reached out to Dr. McCullough, he was very easygoing, wonderful guy. He agreed right away to do a presentation with me on radio, And, you know, we joked and said, wow, wouldn't it be great if you were here in the Bahamas doing this right here? And it really got me to think, why isn't he in the Bahamas doing this right here? You know? And I really was able to approach Optimist and get the type of support that we needed to make an event like this happen. What a wonderful team and group of people. They were so excited to hear that Dr. McCullough was interested in educating the Bahamian people and giving a global view of what's going on with COVID-19, and so much hard work was put into there. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce cardiologist, internist, epidemiologist, and champion for our rights in COVID-19, Dr. Hugh McCullough.
Welcome. Thanks so much for that wonderful introduction. Let's see if I can get this on here.
Thanks
so much for that wonderful introduction, and I'm so sorry about the feedback. Maybe we'll get that mic out of the way. It's a pleasure and a real honor, I think a professional highlight, to come here to the Bahamas, and my wife is with me, Maha, and one of the negotiated points of coming here is it had to be a little bit of a vacation. I haven't had a vacation in 2 years, and what a wonderful place to come, and in many ways, you know, we're envious of how you live here on the islands. And I know living and working here, you're not on vacation either, but at any rate, it's great to come. So as introduced, I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist in Dallas, Texas. I'm in academic practice, and I spend about half of my time seeing patients, and then the other half of my time as a researcher, an author, formerly an editor of two major journals, and a clinical scholar. And so when COVID-19 hit, I was on a series of task forces for our health system. And while we were getting ready with masks and all kinds of other equipment ahead of time, and how the rooms are going to be set up to take care of COVID patients, about 2 or 3 weeks into it, I said, are we going to start treating the illness in order to stop these hospitalizations, or are we just going to let them happen? And there was silence on the call, and it was almost as if doctors were paralyzed with this idea that we would treat COVID-19 and potentially take the risks of getting infected ourselves. So I think a lot of the hesitancy to treat patients was driven out of fear. Doctors, closed their offices. Before you know it, they were supported in closing their offices. They were further supported in doing telemedicine. And we had a situation where, before we knew it, patients were getting sick with COVID, and they were getting no treatment early on. In fact, they were almost waiting to the very end on that last gasp of being hospitalized. And that scenario became, in a sense, a standard. And I think a very dangerous standard. So I jumped into action, and as described, I worked as hard as I possibly could to innovate with various protocols and collaborate, because none of us work in an island, and I was able to get over the finish line, the first protocol of how to treat COVID-19 patients to prevent hospitalizations and death. And independently, a French group led by Didier Rialt and a family practitioner in Monroe, New York, Vladimir Selenko, a general practitioner in Dallas, Yvette Lozano, two doctors in South Central California, Brian Tyson and George Farid, all independently came up with approaches to treat COVID-19. A few months after that, Paul Merrick and Pierre Corey launched the Frontline Critical Care Consortium. They also came in with their ideas. So it should be reassuring to you that many people working in many different areas came up with the same concepts that we could treat COVID-19. But the first segment of the talk is actually not going to be about treatment of COVID-19. Probably the bigger issue on your mind is the vaccines. I mean, COVID's at an all-time low. I don't even know if we have any cases here today in Jamaica, but I can tell you our hospital, big academic medical center in Dallas, It's going weeks at a time now, no patients, none. We have this army of COVID workers and ventilators, and none of it's being used. I think the bigger issue to talk about is the vaccines. So, see if I can get this to work. I was really questioning, Damien, the range on this. So go ahead and advance the slide. I don't think it's going to reach all the way back to where you are. So we're going to have to manually advance. So I don't have a keyboard up. Just go ahead and arrow forward is fine. Did I say Jamaica? Oh, no. And you said, what did you say the other day? You said Trinidad. No, we're not in Jamaica. We're in Bahamas. Love it. Maha and I had our honeymoon in Jamaica, and maybe that's what's on my mind. So, how good it is here. Is that a good comeback? Okay, Damien, I'm going to propose that we scrap the advancer, and you just go ahead and arrow forward, because we've already had our first obligatory technical. No presentation ever goes off without a technical glitch. Okay, so we've had. So the first point I want to make is there's a historical precedent in the United States on mass vaccination. And there's been several of them. But one to recall is the swine flu pandemic, 1976. Many of you were alive. 1976, I was 14 years old. This was going on. Gerald Ford was the president. We had 220 million Americans. We had gotten to about a quarter of Americans vaccinated against the swine flu. And at 25 deaths and 550 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a form of ascending paralysis, the program was shut down. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. There was no VAERS or Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Just good old common sense concluded that we can't give injections and have people die after an elective injection. It's unacceptable in American society. Now, the deaths ultimately rose to 53 deaths, and apologies were given, there were reparations, there were payments, but the point is, it's unacceptable to have anyone take an injection electively and die. It's absolutely unacceptable. It's not something that our country has ever thought is okay to do. Just go ahead and do arrow forward. We have the same one. Yeah, it doesn't work. I think it's a range issue. You know how it is when a remote, once you start pressing it, really a whole bunch of buttons, it's just not going to work. So let's just do arrow forward, Damien, when I tell you to, because it's just, it's, my wife hates when I say this, it's busted tech. It's tech that doesn't work. So, or maybe you can, Pastor, if you can just sit a little bit closer, you can just arrow advance it. But let's hit the next slide, otherwise it's going to be a really long night. Just take it back to him. So there's Gerald Ford, and you know, he wanted a successful part to the presidency, and he isn't the first person who actually would want their whole career to be, in a sense, having the capstone be saving the population with the vaccine. I think this is a dream of many people, and I think right now in the United States is a dream of many people in public health that they're going to save the United States, if not save the world, with a vaccine. And with COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and COVID-19, the illness, the one thing I think we learned relatively quickly is it's not like polio. It's not an enterovirus. We're not going to get to zero cases. So this idea of getting to zero cases is a fool's errand, in my view, because the virus is sufficiently contagious. It's a respiratory virus. We don't get to zero cases of the flu. We don't get to zero cases of pneumococcal pneumonia or zero cases of mycoplasma pneumonia. Since when do we declare zero cases? I think where the concept came from with SARS-CoV-1, the original SARS virus, which was involved China and then some cities in Canada, where it was around for 90 days and it kind of burned itself out. We did get to zero cases of SARS-CoV-1, mainly because the body's immunity was so good, and the immunity that people formed literally just shut off the ability for the virus to spread. So SARS-CoV-1, you know, came in and came out in about 90 days. And I think people in their minds said, listen, for COVID-19, we're basically going to get to zero cases. Let's lock down. Let's shut down the airplanes. Let's really put a lid on this. And getting to zero cases became a pipe dream. So we're going to follow this outline. I'll make a few comments with respect to each one of these bullets. Let's go forward now. Just kind of go forward. Good. And we could have practiced this for hours. We would have had the same sets of problems, believe me. So one more time. Okay. I'm going to, listen, these little guys just don't reach this far. Let's try. Okay. New biological products. The point I want to make is we always demand safety, safety, safety. Some of you heard me on today with Juan on radio. He wanted to get efficacy of the vaccines. What do the vaccines do? I said, no, we have to discuss safety first. We always discuss safety because if products are not safe, it doesn't matter how good they are. It's just like a car. If you have a car, no matter how much you like it, it's attractive, it goes fast. If you drive that car off the lot and 3 out of 100 cars blow up and people die in the car is not safe. It's not going to ever get into commercial production. Drugs don't go at all in commercial production if they're not safe. So we demand safety, safety, safety. This is America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is free and available to you here in the Bahamas. And each week I issue a report to the nation. It's called America Out Loud Talk Radio McCullough Report. Dr. Archer Cartwright is our guest this week on the show. But feel free to tune in. It comes in on Saturday and Sunday at 11 a.m. and then 5 p.m. Encore. Then it hits the Apple iHeart iPod podcast schedule on Tuesday. But everything I have in here is cited. And we have terrific guests. One of my big points on the show is that COVID-19 is an international problem. And in the United States, we have seen no international perspectives. We have seen no view of how other countries have handled COVID-19. So I've interviewed people from India, Malaysia, from South America, all over. And it just frustrates me of how in the United States, how the media cycle is just condensed down to such a myopic view. In the summer of 2020, I published an op-ed in The Hill titled The Great Gamble of the COVID-19 Vaccine Development Program. And the point of this paper, this is before the vaccines came out. This is before the vaccines. I was expressing my concerns that these were rushed through development. They were using brand new technology, a form of genetic technology. They weren't traditional vaccines where we would form an immunity to something and then try to do the best we can, that we were installing genetic material into human beings. And I expressed my concern. The reason why I bring it up is this is before the public program was launched, and I want people to understand that. The virus, and all of us now are closet virologists. Every person now knows what a nucleocapsid is. The nucleocapsid is the ball of the virus. The spike protein are these red buds on the surface of the virus. What you need to know is the nucleocapsid itself is relatively harmless. All the danger in COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, the virus, is in the spike protein. The spike protein itself is, in a sense, a lethal biological entity. It's about 1,200 amino acids. It has about 12 what's called glycosylation side chains. The external segments called the S1 segment, it locks with the human ACE2 receptor. In order to be able to inject its contents into the human body. There's a linkage joint there called the furan-clevis joint that looks like it was manipulated in the lab in Wuhan, China, with collaboration from the U.S. National Institutes of Health and Ralph Baric and the Eco Health Alliance. Senator Rand Paul has been on this with our director of the National Allergy Immunology Branch of the NIH. So there is a lot about the spike protein, but everybody should understand the spike protein because so many people have had the spike protein in their body because of the vaccines as we have them. On the right is Pfizer and Moderna, their messenger RNA vaccines, and on the left is Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. The vaccines inject genetic material in human cells, and then the genetic material produces the spike protein. So we actually produce the dangerous protein ourselves as a product of taking one of these vaccines. The genetic material is loaded on lipid nanoparticles. Again, this is a first for vaccine development, to load genetic material and lipid nanoparticles, inject it into the body, let the lipid nanoparticles distribute wherever they're going to go in the body, and wherever they land, they install the genetic code for the spike protein, and then it's expressed in cells. Again, these are the red buds, and then the body starts attacking the red bud. That's an antigen-presenting cell, but it's now known that actually T cells and natural killer cells start attacking our own cells as we produce the dangerous spike protein. So the spike protein is produced in an uncontrolled fashion, with an uncontrolled quantity, and for an uncontrolled duration of time. Never have we had a vaccine that do that. When you get a tetanus shot, you get a specific amount of tetanus toxoid. When you get a flu shot, you get a specific number of either killed viral particles or replication incompetent viral particles. There is a quantity control. With genetic vaccines, there is no control over quantity. Now you can imagine lipid nanoparticles probably distribute everywhere in the body that they could possibly go. Some people must have a lot just stay in the arm, and by luck, not much of it leaves the arm, and they're fine. They have a sore arm for a day or two, and they're fine. Other people, they must, by luck or other determinants, have wide distribution. We now know in people who have had autopsies, after being vaccinated, shortly after being vaccinated, they've had autopsies. These were done in Vienna, Austria, and Germany. We can see the fingerprint of the vaccine everywhere in the body. It's in the brain, it's in the heart, it's in the bone marrow, it's in the reproductive organs, and the lymph nodes. This is also a first. We've never had a vaccine that goes into the human brain, as an example. We've never had a vaccine go into the human heart. And so just these observations alone are very disconcerting. The alarm bells started to go off on the mass vaccination program early in 2021. The first was actually from a French group in March of 2021. I was working with a South American European group. I'm the second author in this paper. But we published this paper and sent it to every authority worldwide. The title of the paper is SARS-CoV-2 Mass Vaccination, Urgent Questions That Demand Answers from International Health Agencies, 57 authors, 17 countries. And we basically said this, that we have messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA technology where the spike protein is produced in cells, tissues, and organ systems, and the spike protein at that point in time was known to start damaging organs, causing blood clotting. The spike protein must be in body fluids, it must be in donated blood, and there would seem to be no quality control or interest in the blood supply. There was no genotoxicity, teratogenicity, or oncogenicity studies. There was a concerning ovarian biodistribution study where the Japanese asked Pfizer, and Pfizer showed the lipid nanoparticles hyperconcentrate in mammalian ovaries. There was a reduced fertility study that Moderna produced for the European medicine agencies. There were no safety committees for the big public program. In the randomized trials, there is a critical event committee, data safety monitoring committee, and human ethics committee or institutional review boards. None of that was actually installed for the public program. There was no restriction of the properly excluded groups who randomized trials. Pregnant women, women of childbearing potential, COVID survivors, previously immune people, they were all excluded from the randomized trials because the FDA, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca, those individuals either were going to be damaged with the vaccines or they couldn't benefit from the vaccines. That's the reason why we exclude people from trials. But suddenly, without any data whatsoever, in the public program, pregnant women were being encouraged to take the vaccine. We have never done that in the history of medicine, develop a drug or a vaccine, exclude pregnant women, and then when it gets in the public market, just tell people to take it anyway. So we started to see things that were basically fundamental violation of regulatory principle and law happening. There was no risk stratification. It wasn't just focused on those at high risk who could end up in the hospital. There was no data transparency and no efforts to mitigate risk. Once bad things started to happen, there was no emergency meetings to say, what are we going to do to make the vaccines safer? Then the paper started coming. This one was published from Stanford by Holkin and colleagues that demonstrated, really much to the shock of the vaccine manufacturers, but not to others who were carefully following it, that the messenger RNA was found in lymph nodes 60 days after the vaccine. So shot one, the body doesn't clear it out, and then shot two is another loading of messenger RNA. That's as far as they looked in the tissues. The vaccines, the physical genetic code may stay in the body far longer than this. This paper just hit has generated a lot of fanfare. Marcus Alden and colleagues from Malmo, Sweden, demonstrated that the Pfizer vaccine reverse transcribes through an enzyme called line 1. That means DNA is made from the Pfizer RNA code and then is installed into the human genome, or is at least found in chromatin about 6 hours after injection. Now, this was using a human hepatoma cell line, so they had to get the right cell line. They had to get the right conditions. But the CDC has always said, don't worry, these vaccines don't alter human DNA. This is the first paper to show that at least the middle 444 base pair clearly is in human DNA. And many experts believe if the middle part of the code gets in it, then the full length of the code must reverse transcribe. If this is true, if this paper is true, this has massive implications. Now, it's going to have to be validated. It's going to have to be a lot of additional work. But if this is true, this means people who have taken the vaccine now actually have a permanent alteration in their genes, that they themselves have the code for this dangerous Wuhan spike protein that was altered in the lab in China, that they themselves, years later, could potentially produce the spike protein either on a chronic low level to cause disease or on an inducible level, and that means in the setting of a stress, produce a lot of it, and then create spike protein disease in the body, which I'll tell you, clearly the spike protein causes disease. But this is far and away the most worrisome paper that's been published since the release of the vaccines. And if it's true, we could be in real trouble because parent cells would pass it on to daughter cells. That means gametocytes, that is sperm and egg, will contain some of this and pass it down to the baby. And we'll never be able to get this spike protein out of the human species. This is an extremely, extremely important development. A student in a lab in Sweden was the first one to show it, and we are anxiously awaiting lots of confirmation. Many groups now are working on confirmation. This paper hit, very concerning, from Harvard, Elena Agata. Circulating spike protein was found in the blood for 1 to 15 days after injection. The longest was 29 days. The spike protein was only supposed to be local, a sore arm, that's it. Now that we understood that there was free-floating spike protein that could itself be distributed to more organs and cause more damage, the concern factor among doctors became great that these vaccines could actually indeed cause considerable damage in the human body. Banzel and colleagues showed that the spike protein is encapsulated in what's called exosomes, or little phospholipid packets. That means the spike protein, instead of being digested by human enzymes, is actually protected and can travel on its own. It can travel along nervous tracts, the vagus nerve in particular. It clearly can enter the brain. The spike protein's been found in the brain. The exosomes actually keep the spike protein from being recognized by the immune system. So the spike protein is allowed to go cause disease, but the human body quickly loses its immunity to the spike protein. It's one of the reasons why the vaccines run out of their effects so quickly. So this is the worst of all worlds as we continue to follow the literature on this. The Chinese started to warn us on this. This paper hit from Liu and colleagues, looking at the various changes that happen in blood after the vaccines were administered. And you can read the bottom line there. The bottom line is, altogether, the Chinese told us These findings are going to predict that once we start using vaccines in older, sicker patients, patients with diabetes or medical problems, we are going to get in trouble. Largely, the people who were in the vaccine trials were healthy young people. Old people in nursing homes, people with multiple problems, weren't tested. The Chinese in this paper were warning us, look out, the vaccines are going to cause trouble in those who already have multiple medical problems. I mentioned safety, safety, safety. Even with all these caveats, if we came out with a vaccine program and said, listen, we're desperate, we need something to basically stem the tide of COVID-19, we should have had reviews. I lead clinical trials. I lead large data safety monitoring boards. I can tell you, for a vaccine program this size in the United States, we should have had a monthly review. How many people got the vaccine? What's going on? Were there any side effects? If there were side effects, what were they? How can we make the program safer? And once we got into January and February, there was no safety review. And we asked ourselves, wait a minute, what's going on? They're telling people to take the vaccine, no safety review. I guarantee here in the Bahamas, you had no safety review. In India, they're going absolutely nuts. You know, there are multiple lawsuits in every country. They have suits in the Supreme Court of India saying, listen, Indians have been kept in the dark on what's going on with the vaccines, period. They don't know a single piece of information about what the vaccines are doing in this massive country in India. We had no safety review. To this day, we don't have a safety review. We've had endless press briefings by our National Allergy Immunology NIH director and our CDC director. Not a single time did they review the safety of the vaccine. That in alone and by itself should be incredibly disturbing. We have better safety review on seatbelts and on car safety, or better safety reviews from the National Transportation Administration on airplanes. And here we are expecting Americans and people all over the world to take injections with no review of safety. Very, very alarming. So our vaccine adverse event reporting system started to be interrogated, and independent investigators started publishing. This paper hit in September from Jessica Rose, who's an independent viral epidemiologist. On the left are the number of safety reports, and on the right are the number of deaths. And you can see in 2021, we've got a huge problem. This system keeps track of 278 million shots a year across 70 vaccines, and you can see the rates of reports and deaths that ever get reported in the system. And suddenly in 2021, the COVID-19 vaccines are off the Richter scale for adverse event reports and safety. So this paper in alone and by itself will tell you the COVID-19 vaccines are clearly the most dangerous vaccination that's ever been developed and used in human medicine. This is 30 years of data across 70 vaccines, 278 million shots. In fact, the first safety signal was seen on January 22nd. We had only vaccinated 27 million Americans. We already had 182 deaths. The most we ever see in the system is 150 deaths, not temporally related to the vaccines. We were already over the line, and if we had a proper independent data safety monitoring board, the U.S. program would have been shut down in February. In fact, there were no safety programs. The FDA and the CDC are leading the program. So the FDA is normally a safety watchdog. Instead, they've been turned away from safety, and they're told to promote the vaccines. The CDC is supposed to be an outbreak investigation unit. Instead, now they are promoting the vaccines. So we have the wrong agencies basically driving the vaccine program, and it quickly went off the rails. I just updated this slide today based on my radio spot. At the top are the U.S. Americans who have received a booster. Remember, almost all Americans received the vaccines very early on in the program. So in a sense, their vaccines have expired. The only vaccinated Americans, truly vaccinated with any modicum of protection, are those who've taken a booster and taken a booster after November 1st. When you take a look at November 1st and put this together, we only have about 25% of Americans who could make the claim that they're fully vaccinated. Almost everybody who thinks they're vaccinated is not vaccinated because the vaccine has already expired. Because the vaccines have such a limited immunologic lifespan in the United States. Oh, let me make one other point. Look at down at the lower panel. Look at the bottom there. Our rate of vaccination in the United States is nearly at a complete standstill. Fewer than 90,000 people a week At that rate, people aren't taking the vaccines. And they clearly, compared to that big swell we had early on, the interest is very low. This is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. I've just updated it as of March 21st. The U.S. data only. When you go to the OpenVAERS data overlay, OpenVAERS data, and you look at when you, if you don't toggle it over, you're going to get the world's data, which is an incomplete world view. It's the U.S., Japan, Germany, and a few other countries reported, and I think potentially the Bahamas reports in as well. And what you need to do is click the toggle over to the U.S. So I click the toggle over to the U.S. It's U.S. data only. As we sit here today, 14,101 individuals, I want to make sure I get this right, have died shortly after the vaccine. I'm going to get to a better viewing point here. And we have about 200,000 Americans have ended up in the hospital shortly after the vaccine or been seen in emergency rooms. So the mortality figure is 12,103. We've had 5,195 cases of myocarditis. The CDC calls and confirms each one of those. And we've had 13,359 Americans now declared permanently disabled, permanently disabled. The middle panel on the left-hand side shows that it's all the action is in 2021 and now 2022. And the lower panel is the temporal relationship. Almost all of these events occur within 30 days. On the right-hand panel are the different organ injury syndromes from the brain, the heart, the respiratory system, the GI tract, the bone marrow. It's almost anywhere where the vaccine goes, it can cause damage and injury in the human body. I can tell you, looking at this VAERS report, with 12,000 Americans who have died voluntarily after taking an injection, the COVID-19 vaccine is worse than a war. It's worse than most wars. Now, for VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, 86% of the time, the report is made by a doctor, a nurse, or a healthcare professional who thinks the vaccine caused the problem. 14% of the time, it's by the patient themselves or someone else in their behalf. The forms are filled out under the threat of imprisonment or federal fines if they're falsified. So everything up on this red board is airtight. The reports get a preliminary VAERS number, and then the CDC verifies every single one of them. Everything in the red box report is verified. So when I report a case of myocarditis or death, the CDC calls and they check. I've done it, so I know. So these are real people who have lost their lives. Now, the estimates are that this is underreported. You can imagine so many people die. Nobody knows if they took the vaccine. And unless you have the vaccine card and you enter the lot number correctly, and the lot numbers, by the way, are handwritten on cards. So if we enter in the lot number incorrectly or don't have the vaccine card, there's no report. So the estimates are this is underreported. We know from other sources of data that this is underreported by a factor of 5 or potentially a factor of 20. These are very, very large numbers, and there are papers now, many papers describing how the vaccine actually injures these organs. This one by Almas and colleagues describe in the peer-reviewed published literature this new set of diseases, many of them cardiovascular. This paper by Pantazakos and Seligman is particularly concerning. They used U.S. Census data as well as vaccine administration data and looked at death from 0 to 20 weeks, and they concluded that the upper bound of a confidence interval for death could be as high as 187,000 Americans losing their life after vaccination. It could be that bad. Think about the swine flu where we shut it down, Gerald Ford shut it down at 25. These numbers are out of sight. No wonder people are walking off the job. But people know this is happening. People know it. This is too big to not have come out. It's too big to conceal. People know this is going on. You know, in the middle of 2021, there was an informal internet survey where the question popped up and said, do you know somebody in your circles or your family circles or church circles who's died shortly after the COVID-19 vaccine? The answer was 12%. I can tell you that number is much higher. Right now, I ask for show of hands sometimes, and people, large numbers of people raise their hands, so it's now known. Look at the temporal relationship to getting the vaccine and when the deaths occur. It's very tightly temporally related. Two studies, Rosa McLachlan show 50% of the deaths within 48 hours, 80% of the deaths occur within a week. It's a quick death when it happens. This paper by McLachlan and colleagues from Queens and London early in the pandemic in April looked at the vignettes that are submitted in VAERS with 1,200 deaths at that time and had doctors independently code the vignettes on causality. Could the vaccine have actually caused the death? Their conclusion, 86% of the deaths had no other explanation outside the vaccine. People were healthy enough to walk into a vaccine center and 2 days later they had died. McLachlan showed who's dying after the vaccine. The people at the upper part of the age spectrum are seniors. The very people who die of COVID-19 were dying of the vaccine. How could that happen? Because the mode of death is the same. With COVID-19, the spike protein is the lethal part of the respiratory pathogen, just like the spike protein is the least lethal part of the vaccine sequence of events that, in a sense, is too much for some of our seniors. And so that death signal can't be seen because people are at the end of life anyway, and then they suddenly die and take the vaccine. One of the first examples was Hank Aaron, famous baseball player. He took the vaccine early in January of 2021. He had a press release. He felt great. His wife took it. And then about 17 days later, he died. People said, what happened? How did he die so quickly? And then the cases kept coming. Midran Lewis, who was a CNN correspondent, Marvin Hagler, Larry King took the vaccine and got COVID and there was some confusion and died afterwards. Colin Powell, a former Secretary of State, was triple vaxxed, had multiple myeloma, had COVID. At the end, he dies. We don't know the implications of the vaccine. And then it keeps going and going. You know, we're at hundreds and hundreds of soccer players and rugby players in Europe who have dropped dead on the field. And the only thing that's changed in 2021 is the vaccine. We now have reports pouring in from life insurance companies, one after another, and working age individuals now are dying at record numbers. A 10% increase in actuarial death is considered a once in a lifetime or once in a millennium or 100-year event. But we're having 40% upward shift in almost every insurance company now. The only thing that's changed is administration of the vaccine. This analysis by Kostoff and colleagues, on the left is the respiratory illness, and on the right is the vaccines. The age distribution of respiratory illness deaths matches almost perfectly the age distribution of the vaccine deaths. The only difference is the y-axis. But it's the same susceptibility pattern to death when it occurs. The Kostoff analysis was presented to the FDA in September and October of last year. It'll probably be presented next week. And this has not been disputed by the FDA. There's no one at the FDA that is saying the vaccines don't do this. They are simply silent as they move forward with progressive approvals. Kostoff concluded that someone age 65 is more likely to die of the vaccine than actually die of COVID-19. Why? Because when you get the vaccine, there's a 100% chance it's in your body. You can't get it out. If you forego the vaccine, you may or may not get COVID. If you're lucky enough to be down here in the Bahamas, you're not going to get any exposure. So you can imagine what a bad proposition it is to be in the Bahamas where you have such a low density of COVID. You take the vaccine, your only thing that can happen if you're not going to come in contact with COVID is actually die of the vaccine, and likely that's happening in your country. Now, the American Thinkers got a summary that we have 1,000 papers in the peer-reviewed literature on vaccine injury syndromes. This is independent of VAERS. This is just cases and case series and cohorts that are being reported by academic medical centers, over 1,000 papers, fatal and non-fatal. Fatal and non-fatal. So we don't even need to rely on VAERS. This is now in the peer-reviewed literature. This website, which is a 501c3 has a vaccine research handbook now. And the handbook lays out all the vaccine injury syndromes with links to the original papers. So I provide this now to people who are seeking exemptions and other things, saying, listen, why don't you just use this document? It's about 40 pages, but it outlines everything in the peer-reviewed literature that can happen after taking a vaccine. And you know, about 200 of those 1,000 papers are myocarditis or heart inflammation. I'm a cardiologist, so I'm seeing and handling this. What you need to know is this paper by Avolio and colleagues demonstrated that the spike protein, now shown in blue buds here, clearly damages heart cells. The cells that are damaged are called pericytes. They're support cells around the capillaries and the cardiomyocytes. And this analysis, Tracy Hoke, the senior investigator at University of California, Davis, showed that in a young person, and they used VAERS and VSAFE data, a young man, now about 90% of the myocarditis cases are young men, that a young male, 86% of the time when they get COVID-induced myocarditis, they're hospitalized. Healthy boys have a considerably higher chance of being hospitalized due to the vaccine than they do with COVID-19 and respiratory illness. So the cost of analysis and the Hoke analysis have been presented to the FDA multiple times in the open public session, and the FDA has not disputed these, and they're in the peer-reviewed literature. One is more likely to do poorly with a vaccine than take your chances with COVID. These analyses occurred before Omicron, which is a far milder syndrome. Sharf and colleagues showed from Kaiser Permanente Northwest that the highest risk of myocarditis is in men ages 18 to 24. These are college age or military age consenting men, over 500 cases per million. The background rate of myocarditis, which can happen due to parvoviruses or adenoviruses or other causes, is 5 cases per million per year. That's the baseline. The CDC estimated, it's going to be 62 cases per million. Now the reality is 500 cases per million, and this is what we know about, and is growing and growing and growing, and as more and more children receive the vaccine, more and more can be expected to be injured. This is heart muscle damage. The entire field of cardiology is predicated on preserving the heart tissue, not allowing any damage. Do you know when there's a microscopic bit of damage in a heart attack, we go in and we open up the artery and we give medications and it's a big deal? Any bit of heart damage is a big deal. And already our agencies have said that it's mild and that it's inconsequential. And I'm telling you, as a cardiologist, those statements are absolutely positively unacceptable. And I've testified under oath in the U.S. Senate, multiple state senates, one case of myocarditis. One case is too many because the children don't have any opportunity to benefit from the vaccines clinically because COVID-19 is so mild and so many children have already had COVID-19. That one case would be unacceptably high. Sadly, the Canada, the UK, and Australia now have treatment guidelines of what doctors should do with all these cases of myocarditis in young people. This paper I published with Jessica Rose showing the men are in aqua, that this tail of risk extends all the way up into the 60s and 70s. In fact, there's been a couple 60-year-old men who have sustained heart damage. Now, some men and women already have a heart problem. They've had heart damage or a heart valve or prior myocardial infarction or heart failure. We would never give something that causes heart damage. The FDA says the vaccines cause heart damage. Now, Pfizer and Moderna have official warnings by the FDA, but there are peer-reviewed papers showing that AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson do it too. Those peer-reviewed papers exist. We would never give something that could cause heart damage to a heart patient. And I was asked on national TV one day, Dr. McCullough, what do you think about heart transplant programs that are giving the vaccine to people who are barely hanging on to life waiting for a heart transplant? I said, no good doctor would do that. No good doctor would give something that damages the heart to somebody with heart failure. And to even be more incredulous, I've learned that heart transplant programs, once somebody gets a heart transplant, are again forcing the vaccine on it to cause damage to an immunologically vulnerable transplanted heart. So something is in the minds of cardiologists that's causing them to administer a dangerous, damaging substance that the FDA agrees is dangerous and damaging to patients with heart disease. Schauer and colleagues now has demonstrated in these series of myocarditis, as shown on the bottom, they all have active heart damage by MRI. MRI is the go-to test now, and they have what's called late gadolinium enhancement, which shows damage is occurring. The hearts literally light up like a Christmas tree. They have elevations in troponin, EKG changes, signs and symptoms of heart failure. The top panel shows that the symptom configuration can be quite subtle, just some general body aches, general malaise. So we actually really don't know how many kids are being damaged with the vaccine. Whatever's happening is far bigger than what's in the reports that we see right now. This is Schauer's follow-up paper. It just recently was published, demonstrating that the inflammation in the heart, as shown in MRI in the bottle with the arrows, does not go away. This is over 4 months later, there's active damage going on in the heart in the children who have received the vaccines and been diagnosed with myocarditis. This is extremely alarming. It's not a quick thing. It's a persistent thing. And I think as more and more children get vaccinated, we're going to see, unfortunately, the consequences of this being the development of heart failure or cardiac death. Fatal cases are now reported. This paper by Choi and colleagues, 22-year-old man in Korea, takes the vaccine, has chest pain for about 7 days, comes in the hospital, and he dies within 7 hours. He has an autopsy. His heart is loaded with inflammation. Everything on the slide here that's not nice pink, but it's kind of bluish and whitish, that's inflammation. The heart is loaded with inflammation, and he dies of myocarditis. He dies of myocarditis. A confirmed fatal case of myocarditis. Just ahead of this, there was a confirmed fatal case from Washington University in St. Louis. And then this paper just hit from Gill and colleagues, Connecticut, backed up by pathologists from the University of Michigan and the University of Minnesota. Two boys who are teenage boys take Pfizer, and after the second dose, the boys die on days 3 and 4 after the vaccine. And they die at home. They don't even get a chance to get CPR. The parents find their dead children, and they're horrified, and the parents are smart enough to get autopsies. They get the coroner involved, and sure enough, the hearts are loaded with inflammation. And there's a pattern of what's called superimposed catecholamine toxicity, and it implies that maybe the kids went and played sports, or they had some adrenaline, or maybe it was in the final gasps of life, and it takes a lot to kill a 17-year-old boy. Let me tell you what, these deaths are not quick, and I'm sure the boys really struggled to hang on to life, but no one was at home. No one could do CPR to save them. And so what has been proposed now is this heart inflammation probably is exquisitely sensitive to sports and athletics. And Flavio Cattagiani, who's a colleague of mine in Brazil, is advancing this hypothesis, and he is concluding that is the real risk to athletes, is what's been learned here. But since fatal cases are in the peer-reviewed literature, Archives of Pathology is one of the better journals, the FDA should have absolutely positively changed the consent forms, warned parents. This should have had red bells going off, alarms going off all over the world. Instead, there's been no discussion of these fatal cases that are coming in. This paper by Tashopi and colleagues prior to COVID is making the point that in myocarditis in young people, about a third of them have heart damage that doesn't completely recover, and about 13% have deep heart damage that's going to lead to heart failure or, in the end, death. And when I went on Joe Rogan, it wasn't me, but it was Joe who knew about a case of a young girl in Minnesota who developed heart inflammation, myocarditis, and she was in that 13% group, and she got worse and worse, and she went to heart transplant, and she got a heart transplant, and she died shortly afterwards. Joe is the one who presented that, not me. But it's known in context that myocarditis is fatal. So without protection from pharmaceutical laws, the vaccines will do more harm. We actually have laws that say that we must have informed consent. We must have truth in advertising. The words safe and effective don't completely apply to the vaccines. It's not a truthful statement based on the data that I'm showing you. Now the newly released Pfizer documents reveal COVID vaccine data that is in many ways has basically confirmed that Pfizer, as the lead manufacturer, knew about this. They knew about this. People were reporting into Pfizer within 90 days of release of their vaccine. There were 1,223 deaths reported to Pfizer, 1,291 adverse events of interest. Pfizer had 1,223 deaths on their books 90 days after release of the vaccine, and they didn't say a word. The FDA didn't say a word. This isn't self-report. This is what they knew. This is what was coming in with their products. It was reported from all over the world. I'm telling you, 50 deaths, any product manufacturer has a duty to pull the product off the market. 50 is the convention. Some pull it off much sooner. But pull the product off the market and figure out what's wrong. Maybe it's being manufactured incorrectly. Maybe there's some contaminant. I mean, we've been through heparin contaminations. We've had hundreds and hundreds of drugs pulled off the market when this happened. We've had Tylenol contamination. Pfizer didn't do a thing. And I guarantee in the end, Pfizer's going to say, listen, it was the FDA's fault. The FDA didn't tell us to stop. The FDA's going to say it's Pfizer's fault. They didn't pull it off the market. And they're going to point fingers at one another. But this must be understood, that this cannot be viewed as being acceptable. This cannot be viewed as being safe. There can't be a single doctor in the Bahamas who can stand behind these vaccines and say they're safe with these developments. They can't. And in fact, they won't. And Steve Kirsch, who started the COVID-19 Early Treatment Fund and now the Vaccine Injury Fund, has an open offer. Now it's in press. It's been the Senate record. He started out by offering a doctor $1 million if they'll come to the table and defend the vaccines as being safe and effective. Nobody. $2 million. $5 million. $10 million. Any doctor at the CDC, FDA, or NIH, any doctor at academic medical center who will have a roundtable discussion and take the viewpoint that the vaccines are safe. No takers. Not even the most junior unpaid faculty member at a medical school will come forward and make the case that the vaccines are safe and effective. Ron Johnson held a Senate hearing on January 24th of this year, and I co-moderated it. We had a dozen or more expert clinicians. We had vaccine developers, messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA developers, and we had nurses, patients, and others. We had seats for all of our public health officials. Anybody who you've seen on TV promote the vaccines, they had a seat in the Kennedy caucus room. Not a single person showed up. It was filmed. It's recorded in history. They know that we know, and they know that this is not right. It's very, very important. They also know that this isn't right. We can't have media correspondents on the left as a doctor. They can't go on Sesame Street and advertise the vaccines. We have laws about that. The laws say that must be presented in fair balance. If they want to go on and say, take the COVID vaccine, they have to say, warning, could cause heart inflammation, could cause immediate death. There has to be a balance. Do you know other products are advertised in the United States, and they have fair balance? They have psoriasis drugs that say, well, it could cause psoriasis, but could cause allergic reactions, or it could cause tuberculosis, or what have you. But we have right now unbridled advertisements that are advertising the vaccines without fair balance. And to make matters worse, we have our president who's barking commands at us to, quote, get vaccinated. Historians are going to record that while the U.S. president is telling us to get vaccinated, Pfizer is amassing the list of deaths of people who are dying after the vaccine. Can you imagine how this president and everybody who's saying get vaccinated is going to go down in history? Can you imagine how your medical directors and your public health directors and your prime ministers here in the Bahamas are going to go down in history? They're going to go down in history. They've actually encouraged the population to take the vaccine. Nobody here is anti-vax. I've personally taken every vaccine that I'm supposed to take in the schedules. My wife has, my kids has, we've traveled, we take an extra vaccine. I have no problem with vaccines. Vaccines have done a wonderful job for polio and meningococcal disease and hemophilus, etc. Wonderful. We're not anti-vax. But when large numbers of people are dying, and We are being told to do this anyway, and in fact, it's being linked to our employment and our travel, what have you. That's the reason why people are now at the point where we understand the vaccines aren't safe. They're not safe for human use on either side. This isn't my opinion or some of the doctors here. Dr. Tess Lowry leads the evidence-based consulting group in the UK. There's a lead consulting group to the World Health Organization. They reviewed the yellow card data, not the VAERS data, the yellow card data, whole separate system. They produced a 20-page report to the MHRA, which is the FDA. You can see the conclusions. Vaccines are not safe for human use. Not safe. Pull them off the market. Evidence-based consulting group led by Dr. Lowry, she is every bit as competent or more competent than I am, gave the independent opinion. The UK was told, take them off the market. They didn't ask. They were told, take them off the market. There's been citizen petitions groups into the FDA led by Peter Doshi at the University of Maryland and Linda Westiela. Peter's the associate editor of British Medical Journal. I signed on with that one and helped them with that one. The nurses have submitted petition groups saying, listen, the vaccines aren't safe. They're not approvable. At best, they could be offered purely electively as a high-risk option, but they're not safe. Now, people have said, listen, Dr. McCullough, I've already taken the vaccine. Don't I get some credit? Aren't I protected against COVID? Don't the vaccines do what they're supposed to do? Well, coming out of clinical trials, the vaccines had 90% vaccine efficacy, meaning they did protect against COVID, the original wild type and probably alpha variant. But there was no reductions in hospitalizations and death. In fact, the Pfizer program in September of last year published their full dossier. There were more deaths with Pfizer than placebo in the randomized trials. But the only claim a vaccine has, according to the FDA, is that it can prevent COVID, the respiratory illness at home, in somebody who has not had COVID. For somebody who's had COVID, the vaccines are too late because they're only indicated to prevent COVID. It doesn't work backwards. You don't take a vaccine now and go back in history. So when you've had COVID, it's too late for the vaccines. And people say, wait a minute, they do more. They protect against severe disease. Well, the best study that makes this case is by the Ivy Network, published in JAMA a few months ago, that had fully vaccinated and unvaccinated people in the hospital with COVID. And so everything in this data table is with COVID. And so the mortality rate of those fully vaccinated was, and I want to get the exact number, so I'm going to walk way over here. I'm sorry, I'm walking away from you, but I have to be able to see it. It was 6.3% mortality rate in those who were fully vaccinated in the hospital. 45% of the cases had Delta. And for the unvaccinated, it was 8.6% mortality rate, and the p-value was 0.36. This is the best data we have. So yes, there is a trend towards an improved mortality. But the vaccines did not stop death in those who were hospitalized with COVID-19. Far from it. And it's not statistically significant. Now, the Swedes have published some very good comparative analyses. This is Nordstrom and colleagues, Pfizer and Moderna. The outcome here is just the respiratory illness. And this is earlier in the program, but it's 1.6 million matched pairs. It's not randomized trials, but it's matched pairs. Pretty good methodology. You can see that the vaccine efficacy is about 90% initially for Pfizer and Moderna, but it drops way down. In fact, Pfizer drops below 20% protection at about 6 months. If a vaccine can't offer at least 50% protection and last at least a year, it's not a viable commercial entity. I don't think an insurance company would even approve a vaccine that can't last a year and give 50% protection. That's the minimum, what's called acceptance standards. We now have 22 studies showing the vaccines lose their efficacy over about 3 to 6 months. So they don't last. And that was my question. That was my question to Juan today. I said, are you really vaccinated? When did you take your booster? You know, if somebody is not taking a booster now, after November 1st, they're unvaccinated. Most of your friends who think they're vaccinated are actually unvaccinated because the vaccine is worn off. It's obsolete. I was on a podcast with this investor guy, Shad, and he was a really sharp guy. He was telling his viewers, he was, I'm vaccinated. He kind of had his, you know, like he had two stripes on his side. I'm vaccinated. I said, Shad, it's not like a tattoo. I said, it only lasts about 6 months. When did you take your booster? He goes, oh, back in August. I go, you're as unvaccinated as I am. Most people are unvaccinated because they're not keeping up with the boosters because they're worried about safety. And the problem is, by mass vaccinating the world, you know about two-thirds of the world has taken one of these shots. Now, it's not all Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca. It's not all genetic vaccines. A lot of the world has taken Sinovac, which is a killed virus vaccine from China. Some have taken Novavax, which is a purified antigen vaccine. So it's not all one vaccine manufacturer. They all have different qualities. But because the vaccines don't sterilize the body from the virus, the vaccines don't stop the virus from invading the body, the virus has learned to live in people who are vaccinated. The virus is learning. And because the normal infection, there's antibodies, as shown in a paper by Hakim, there's antibodies against at least 15 proteins, probably way more, but 15 are demonstrable. The vaccines cause antibodies just against one protein, the spike protein. The vaccines are very narrow in terms of their immunity. They give almost no immunity to the sinuses, and that's where you need it, because we need secretory IgA, and very little stimulation of T cells or natural killer cells. So by taking a shot in the arm, it doesn't do much in the sinuses. That should be common sense to almost all of your patients. Now, if the vaccines, a recent paper by Hamid Mershant from UK, who's a vaccine developer, he said if the vaccines were a nasal spray or something that we actually got the vaccine in the right place, that could be a different story. But a shot in the arm to protect against the sinus infection is not something that's solid. Now, this paper by Singarajam, when this hit, this should have shut down every single vaccine mandate that ever was going to come along. And in this paper from Lancet, they demonstrated that 39% of all the transmission in a very well-done case-control study was fully vaccinated to fully vaccinated. The only reason why an employer or a travel entity like an airplane or a military or anyone else would ever want to have a vaccine is to have a perfectly safe workforce. But when this paper hit, and it became obvious that the fully vaccinated are transmitting it to one another, it should have been over with. In fact, our CDC director was out ahead of this paper, actually after the several events, and said, listen, the vaccines don't stop transmission. Do you know, to this day, the CDC does not indicate that we should have mandates. The CDC doesn't. You know, four out of the five Biden mandates were struck down in the Supreme Court. And they were struck down, actually, based on the testimony of two doctors, and you're looking at one of them, me and Jay Bhattachar from Stanford. But I can tell you that all of the vaccine mandates right now are not supported by the US FDA, the CDC, the NIH, or the World Health Organization. There's no regulatory organization that supports vaccine mandates. So any mandates that you don't have them here in the Bahamas, but we certainly have them in the United States, they're overreaching. They are reaching past any type of regulatory support. Now, the Omicron variant broke through natural immunity and, in fact, infected very heavily the fully vaccinated. Now, the Omicron variant, as shown down in the lower left, is the most highly mutated form of the virus. And these are just the mutations of the spike protein. But because Omicron has so many mutations, there's an opportunity for some of the mutations to drop out and create subvariants. So I was on TV last night in the Bahamas, and you know, I made the observation that it's so heavily mutated that if you back mutate or correct some of those mutations, you can end up with the BA1 or BA2 subvariant, with the XE, XD, XF. It's all within the Omicron family. It's all equally mild. There may be various differences in infectivity or contagiousness, but the bottom line is the body forms immunity to Omicron and forms a back immunity to Delta. There's essentially no Delta anymore. We are dealing now with a version of the common cold. No more, no less. Some people may have a bit more severe symptoms, but it is very mild. Now, in the official CDC communication, and this held up over time, 79% of Omicron patients are fully vaccinated. Fully vaccinated. So you'd think the Omicron variant would basically be the end of the vaccine program. You know, so many people were fully vaccinated, and they got burned and got COVID. There was a press release yesterday that through FOIA documents, Freedom of Request, Information Request, 70% of CDC employees who got COVID were fully vaccinated. And the CDC is not mandating the vaccine on the employees, but you can imagine how burned an employee feels when they've taken the vaccine and they get COVID anyway. What's the whole purpose of taking the vaccine? So I updated this today. This is now what's called NowCast. This is the current blend of variants we have. The purple is Omicron. The purple almost completely has replaced Delta within when it came in because it formed an immunologic closure on the Delta outbreak. And now the lighter purple is the BA2 subvariant, which is similar to BA1. It actually has a reinstallation of what's called the S gene, which can be picked up on the PCR primer. It's about the same medical illness. And you can see how the vaccines are creating these hyper-dominant variants. Why is there so much Omicron? Because it does incredibly well in a vaccinated person. Omicron is effectively beat the vaccines, and that's the reason why it's so dominant. So here is our curves since the start. This was the alpha wave, the next one was the delta wave, and then you can see the Omicron curve was astronomical. It was about 5 to 10 times bigger than all the other curves. So it was clear that with a large fraction of the American public vaccinated, Omicron was in a sense preying upon the vaccinated. This paper by Accorsi and colleagues published at JAMA showed that with either a Delta or with Omicron, this is Omicron at the top of the S gene dropout, that the viral loads in those presenting sick with COVID are identical. If someone's had no shots, one shot, two shot, three shots, the vaccines have nothing to do with how much virus is in the nasal passages. Someone who takes these shots, when they get sick, they spread the virus as easily as someone who's never taken a shot. There's no reason to separate people by vaccinated status because they're equally contagious. This paper just came out from Amit and colleagues from Israel. Now we're up to fourth shots. Fourth shots. I presented on TV last night that Israel, after its fourth series of shots, has 14,000 cases in the first 2 weeks afterwards, and now another 9,000 cases 3 weeks afterwards. In Israel, it's completely backfiring. Here, this data table from the efficacy data suggests that it's all below 50% efficacy. In fact, I think one of the Moderna cohorts, it's about 10% protective. It's a waste of time to keep taking third and fourth shots. It should be clear. This is New England Journal of Medicine. Now, the authors conclude, keep taking the vaccines. I can tell you the data suggests that's not a correct conclusion. Here's the information from the Scottish UK data report, the Health Security Agency. And you can see here, vaccination status, cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. It should be obvious. In the orange is fully vaccinated people. In the blue is unvaccinated. It should be obvious who's doing worse. Those who keep taking the vaccination injections are getting more COVID. This is being seen in the UK, Israel, Denmark, South Africa, anywhere where they're keeping fair data. So the European Health Agency and EMA has said with Omicron, it basically is like a natural booster. It's wonderful to get Omicron. It's like a common cold, and then one gets immunity to more severe forms of COVID-19. The European regulators have basically said that the boosters are failing. Now, the WHO has since reversed some wording on this, but there's not strong support for boosters anywhere around the globe right now. We will have a booster meeting and a childhood meeting coming up next week at the FDA, and there are independent presenters who are scheduled to present if they go through with the meetings. There's now three analyses, Supermanian, Camp and Beatty, this one by Beatty from Calgary, 145 countries. The conclusion is 89% of the countries show an increase in deaths per million directly due to the causal effect of mass vaccination. The vaccines are making it worse when somebody gets COVID. This is now shown across the world. So we must have a pivot to early treatment. The spirit of this is that if you have more cases, let's not lose a single Bahamian from this point forward. We can do it. We can do it together. I testified in the U.S. Senate November 19, 2020, that we should have always had four pillars of pandemic response. Reduce the spread of the virus, early home treatment, late treatment, and vaccination. But the early home treatment is the best opportunity to save lives because there's two bad outcomes, hospitalization and death. And if you don't get hospitalized with COVID, you don't die of COVID. It basically is like a home head cold or sinus infection. We can get through it. So we should have always had in Washington and here in your country teams working on each one of the four pillars. I laid this out for Ron Johnson. I subsequently published it. This was the framework for our second set of historic U.S. Senate testimony. We have never seen this from our leaders in Washington. Our leaders in Washington have never been this organized to have a four-pronged approach. The approach has been simply stay in lockdown, be fearful, and wait to be saved by a vaccine. Right? There wasn't a balanced approach. And the interesting thing is that only pillars two and three deal with sick patients. At any given time, you have very few sick patients. Why not focus on the people sick as opposed to focusing on everybody? If we just focused on people sick, we can actually really narrow down the use of our resources. So vaccinated or not, and I made this case last night on TV with Annika Johnson. She didn't like the point, but I said, listen, vaccinated or not, acute high-risk patients still need early treatment. These are the two seminal papers on early treatment that I published in 2020. I worked really hard with sets of authors to get these over the finish line. We took the precautionary principle, meaning we'll do this in a small group of people who really need it, considering it's a mass casualty event. We look for drugs that have a signal of benefit from all the available evidence, acceptable safety, and then use drugs in combination. You know, even for a staph infection, we don't use a single drug. We use drugs in combination to treat serious illnesses. These were the principles. We were not going to wait for large randomized trials. Large randomized trials take 2 to 5 years. I know that. I do them. We don't have 2 to 5 years. We had literally days and weeks to get things organized. We were not going to wait for large randomized trials. We weren't going to wait for guidelines because guidelines actually have to wait for the large randomized trials. And so when I testified at the U.S. Senate in November of 2020, the minority witness, who has now been named the White House new COVID coordinator, a young man from the East Coast, he kept saying, Dr. McCullough, you don't have enough evidence to do this. And I was recovering from COVID myself, and I remember I was on the Senate floor. I held up my protocol. I said, listen, I'm not asking for permission. I said, I'm doing this. I said, I'm asking for your help because we need all doctors, all good doctors, to step forward and start treating the illness in order to reduce the loss of life. In November 2020, my estimate is at that time we could have saved 50% of the lives because it took a time to learn how to treat it. By March of 2021, I testified in the Texas Senate, I said 85% of lives could have been saved. And then recently in January, just a few months ago, I upgraded, I said now 95% of all the deaths could have been avoided, and easily that of the hospitalizations. We're coming up on 1 million Americans losing their lives and probably 10 million hospitalizations. 95% of it would be avoidable if leaders in Washington would have promoted constructive dialogue, brought in the experts, have the experts volunteer their time. I would have been glad to do so and help America and the world get through COVID-19. What were the principles? That we had a phase of viral proliferation, a phase of cytokine injury, and then a phase of thrombosis of blood clotting. We had the characteristic signs and symptoms. We had a long phase, about 14 days, of viral replication that we can actually intervene here and actually start to use the principles of that we learned in the hospital to treat COVID-19 early to avoid the risk of hospitalization and death. It should be apparent that if we don't do something before the hospital, we can't reduce the risk of hospitalization. What I told Annika last night on the national news here is that she kept saying, well, it's alternative medicine. This is not alternative. It's a standard of care. It's a standard to do so. We have to treat before the hospital to prevent a hospitalization. That's not an alternative. And we don't offer these people these alternatives. We treat ahead of time. Now, these are the characteristics, signs and symptoms, the tests, and what have you. And then these are the approaches. We use intracellular anti-infectives and antiviral antibodies, corticosteroids, immunomodulators, antiplatelet drugs, and anticoagulants. It's not rocket science. It shouldn't be controversial. I don't think anybody ought to be really, you know, getting all lathered up about prednisone or dexamethasone. I mean, come on, we use it in the hospital anyway. We shouldn't get all worried about aspirin or Lovenox. We use it all the time in the hospital. But what's the controversy? People have been charged on certain drugs. To get all charged up about ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. I said, listen, don't get too worried about this. Just remember, it's about 4 to 6 drugs in combination. This is sequenced multi-drug therapy for COVID-19, so-called the McCullough protocol. It's not copyrighted in my name. Now, I've just updated it today because of the rapidly changing monoclonal antibodies, but I'll walk you through it carefully. This is available online at the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, Truth for Health Foundation, many other organizations. Up front, when someone gets COVID-19, we self-quarantine, we start to take action to reduce the spread of the illness. Age under 50, the current and healthy, we just recommend an over-the-counter bundle of zinc, vitamin D, vitamin C, quercetin, and then an over-the-counter antihistamine antacid that reduces viral replication as a off-target effect, metformin or Pepcid, but it's at 4 times the dose, 80 milligrams a day. Again, all of this is supported by randomized trials and very good observational studies. Age under 50, everything doing well. We have watchful waiting, complete the quarantine, and we're done. The current quarantine we're using is 5 days now. The CDC does that for asymptomatic test positive. We do that now clinically in even sick positive patients, provided the last 2 days there's no fever or heavy cough. Now, over age 50, we do the OTC bundle, but we also use monoclonal antibodies, which has been the shifting sand. Our federal government has taken away monoclonal antibody after monoclonal antibody based on theoretical modeling, but has not taken away the vaccines. That should tell you something. They're both high-tech. They're both EUA approved. There's both big pharma interests. Why are the monoclonal antibody manufacturers constantly having their products pulled, whereas the vaccines enjoy market promotion? What is it about treating patients that our federal government or agency doesn't want to do, but about vaccination, which they want to do in an unbridled fashion? That's an important question. So our current monoclonal antibody is bortezomib by Lilly. It's a 2.5 cc injection. Very easy to give, very safe and effective. But I would contend, given the blend of Omicron, we could still be using satralizumab, which is the GSK product. President Trump had received Regeneron, which is carisilimab and indivimab, to give you an idea. But if we don't have monoclonal antibodies available, we use oral antivirals. Hydroxychloroquine, supported by 300 studies, has about a 25% effect on COVID-19. Ivermectin, now at the doses of 600 micrograms per kilogram, that is supported by 70 studies, 35 randomized trials, about a 55% effect, okay? Positive effect, reducing the endpoint of interest. But now we have Paxlovid by Pfizer, about an 85% reduction in hospitalization and death. Molnupiravir by Merck, more problems with that drug, about a 30% effect. So we have oral antivirals. If someone says, I'm all charged up, I don't want to use hydroxychloroquine, fine, use ivermectin or Paxlovid. I was on an ABC News special about ivermectin. They said, Dr. McCullough, you know, aren't you all lathered up about ivermectin? I said, not really. I could use Pfizer. It's not a big deal. Now that we have Pfizer, you know, in the United States, we prescribe it. The copay is covered. They pick it up at the pharmacy. It's not a big deal. Now, we combine it with azithromycin or doxycycline because that covers mycoplasma or chlamydial pneumonia organisms, which overlay about 2 to 3% of the time, and I've had them in my practice. If you miss using those antibiotics, you're going to end up having troubles clinically. We use inhaled budesonide all the way through, supported by 3 randomized trials, colchicine, 1 tablet a day for 30 days all the way through, oral prednisone, dexamethasone, or hydrocortisone with pulmonary symptoms or high-risk features starting at day 5. We accelerate that earlier with Omicron. Aspirin in everyone, 325 milligrams a day. Our Italian colleagues use 700 milligrams a day because it's blood clotting in the end that drops the oxygen saturation and actually contributes to death. And high-risk seniors, people in nursing homes, wheelchairs, immobile individuals, very obese individuals, we use blood thinners. Injectable enoxaparin, or you can also use fraxaparin and other low molecular weight heparin, or we use oral anticoagulants, apixaban, rivaroxaban, dabigatran, et cetera. It's called sequence multidrug therapy. On the extreme left there, we actually use oxygen concentrators at home. We've demonstrated we can treat hypoxemic patients at home. The only people who need to be in the hospital are those who need to go on a mechanical ventilator or are so dehydrated they need an IV. Having a low oxygen saturation is not a reason to be hospitalized, because we can use oxygen at home very easily. Patients actually handle the hypoxemia very well as long as they're not too short of breath and their mentation is fine and they have good home support. So we use oxygen at home all the time now. We've proven it's safe. About 45% of U.S. hospitalizations are panic hospitalizations, where the oxygen saturation is never below 94% once they get to the hospital. That should tell you something. This huge number, this, you know, remember all the emergency use authorization was predicated on the fact that our hospitalizations were going to overflow. And a paper by Fillmore and colleagues at the VA showed that 45% of the hospitalizations are unnecessary. I published this paper with Fazio and colleagues from Italy using multi-drug protocols that do not use ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, so we can use other drugs. And we do find the golden window for early treatment is the first 3 days. First 3 days. We cannot let people get sick for 14 days and then treat them in the hospital. That's clear. One of the most important things we've learned over the course of the pandemic is oral nasal virucidal washes. This is a picture of my kitchen countertop. This is a bottle of povidone iodine for about $5 on Amazon. And we put a half a teaspoon in 1.5 ounces of water, a shot glass of water, a little pinch of salt. Use a spray bottle or a bulb syringe over the sink, squirt it up in the nose, sniff it back all the way around, and spit it out. Do it twice on each side. The remainder, gargle for about 30 seconds. That's a thorough wash. That is the most effective thing you can do at home to knock down Omicron, to abort the infection, or make it far more mild. Every household in the Bahamas should have povidone iodine or have hydrogen peroxide. Either one works. The betadine's a little bit better in the household. No government needed, no government doctor needed, no vaccine needed. Have this simple, safe, and effective intervention. This analysis by Chowdhury and colleagues demonstrated a high-quality, prospective, randomized, double-blind trial demonstrating that compared to a control of actually using a non-iodine solution, that they markedly knocked down the PCR within a matter of days. Think about how effective this is. Think about how many people are no longer infectious when they're actually treating the viral replication in the nasal cavity. You know, we've been giving shots and IVs and remdesivir and all this stuff, and we actually haven't treated the problem. The problem is the virus is replicating in the sinuses. Everybody should know how to do this, and this markedly reduces the positivity of PCR, will reduce spread of the infection if it comes back to the islands, and then the clinical outcomes, need for oxygenation, hospitalization, and death, are dramatically different for those in the blue bars. I'm telling you, this is there's no other drugs given here. This is just high quality, common sense applied. This is something that could have been done in the 1950s. Now, it's done about every 4 hours when people are acutely sick. It can be done once a day for prevention. And it's very important. It's not perfect, but it will make the syndrome far more mild, and it works for other forms of the common cold as well. So we learned, and there's now a total of 12 clinical studies that support it. It has its biggest impact, about a 70% impact on early treatment. That means it's better than hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. I stopped using those drugs for prophylaxis, and you can see a Republican congresswoman calling out last fall, why have the federal government not promoted nasal washes? Why have we not done this? Why has there not been a public service announcement on this breakthrough? This is science. Science evolves. We didn't know this at the beginning, but we know it now, and that's the reason why I focused on it. Now, the FDA has said that we should use drugs off-label. We should be using hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. Why? and prednisone and colchicine. Why? Because in their guidance in 2018 to the public, they said one reason your doctor is going to use a drug off its original advertising label is because the doctor is fulfilling an unmet need. And I've been involved in discussions with the FDA, big public debates, and we all agree drugs should be used off the original advertising label because the original company can't anticipate what the future needs are going to be. So whether it's on-label or off-label, indicator or not, that doesn't matter. It's the doctor's judgment that matters. The one that we all agree on is the package insert should give a full disclosure of safety information. It's called ISI, important safety information. So any doctor here in the Bahamas who prescribes ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, if they were in the United States, they would be fully supported by the FDA's use of off-label drugs. Now in the United States, we actually have laws in place protecting doctors in doing this, and laws in place to say the pharmacist must do this. And now in one state in the United States, ivermectin is over-the-counter in New Hampshire. So ball game over with. There is a massive influx of ivermectin into the United States, and people have it. Almost everybody has some ivermectin. It's game over, because you can imagine ivermectin on top of the nasal washes and other things. We're not going to have our hospitals overrun with COVID. It's not going to happen. Americans have solved the problem that our federal agencies have stumbled over. There's been a home treatment guide available for COVID-19 since the fall of 2020. On the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, AAPSonline.org, Dr. Bleep and myself and others, Dr. Orient, put that together. We treat the viral infection. We handle the pandemic crisis. Remember I showed you that someone's contagious for 2 weeks with COVID. We can reduce that to a few days with the nasal washes and the drugs. This is really important. Early treatment slows the spread of infection. You have fewer cases if you treat the ones that you have. Don't have a case or two hit Grand Bahama or hit New Providence and then let it fester at home. Someone's not going to be there for 2 weeks without somebody else coming in the house. They're going to spread it. They're going to spread it. Treat the next case you have, treat it, so instead of 14 days, it's shortened to a few days. Does early treatment work? There's three studies that show compared to fair comparators. In this case, this is a paper I was involved with Proctor and colleagues, about a 75% reduction in death, fair comparator, 87% reduction in hospitalization. This is with early protocols. This is out without the higher dose ivermectin. This is without monoclonal antibodies, without full use of colchicine or budesonide. So even our earliest protocols from the very beginning worked. We had the right ideas. Former President Trump got the McCullough Protocol in its early form. So did podcaster Joe Rogan. It's one of the reasons why he had me on. So did Aaron Rodgers. So did Governor Abbott of Texas. How many more examples do we need to see that early therapy works? Now, let's not let another patient be denied early therapy. Once we get through the illness, we have a degree of protection from another case. How many people in the room have had COVID? How many of you have had it? At least half. That means if you get COVID again, and if the virus mutates, it's possible you could get another version of it. The original immunity was really good. Wild type through Delta, you didn't get it a second time. But now it's possible. You have almost no chance of being in the hospital or going on the ventilator. It's going to be 6 million Americans, basically nearly half of our population had already had COVID by October. And then down below, I've updated the data tables today. You can see that the vast majority of people who actually got sick with COVID were over age 65. There's no doubt about it. It is a problem of the elderly. It's not a problem of young people. Now, lots of people had infections. You can see over half were people under age 50. But look at the deaths. 76% of the deaths were those over age 65. The focus of COVID-19 should have always been on our seniors. Always. We haven't seen I'm going to walk behind here again. Sorry I did that. I'll just reappear over here. We haven't seen a newsreel with a senior citizen on it for months. All we've seen is an incessant focus on children and young people. Right? Where's the seniors? Most of them have effectively no vaccination. Where's the concern for the seniors? There's none. There is a hyper-focus on children and college-aged children, completely unsupported by the data. In fact, if we actually vaccinate someone who's already had COVID, multiple studies show that we cause harm. That's probably where all this myocarditis is coming from, all these blood clots and all these problems. People have probably already had COVID. They've probably already had one exposure to the spike protein, and now we're loading them with spike protein again with subsequent vaccination. The FDA was right to begin with, and the vaccine manufacturers were right. Someone who's had COVID in, under no circumstances should take a shot of a vaccine. Under no circumstances. People ask me, Dr. McCullough, have you taken the vaccine? I said, I already had COVID. It's too late. I had COVID early. Once you've had COVID, there's no opportunity for a vaccine. There's no therapeutic opportunity. Scott Atlas, he's a frequent contributor on the news with me, and he was in the White House task force, has said the denial of natural immunity in the CMS mandate is unprecedented. Do you know our military is not keeping track of who's had COVID? The sports teams are not keeping track of who's had COVID. I had a conference call today with West Point. And I just said, listen, how do you organize your Delta force? How do you know who's not going to get sick if you go overseas? You have to check the same thing. The NFL has called me. I said, how do you organize your A team and B team? It's a simple checkbox. Keep track. Every doctor's office should have a checkbox. Did you have COVID, yes or no? Because you have to know. The oblivion to who's had COVID and who hasn't is inexplainable. It is a simple thing. Everybody here should know. Did you have COVID or did you not? Now, if you're unclear, there's good antibody profiles. Quest has one that we use all the time, quantitative. You can do a T-detect test, T-detect, and look at T-cell immunity. These are FDA, EUA-approved tests. Why are you here tonight? We're almost done. That, you know, your freedom now has been linked to this idea of getting a shot. We've never done this before. A genetic transfer technology, a genetic vaccine with no proven safety or efficacy, no long-term results, no assurances whatsoever that you're going to do okay with it. Now it's linked to your employment, to your travel, to your future career. Never. You know, when it started out, people didn't mind the vaccines. Last January, even a year ago, it was voluntary. If you want to take a vaccine, take a vaccine. People, my patients used to ask me, I said, it's your choice. I'll help you as the data emerges. I never encouraged it. I never discouraged it. Because they're experimental. They're investigational. We can't encourage these. There's a code of ethics called the Nuremberg Code that says when it's research, we never provide any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal. If I was doing a research study with a pill, and I told people, listen, you need to take this pill, otherwise you can't be in my practice, I would be called before the FDA and say, Dr. McCullough, you're violating research code. You can't force people to take your research pill to be in your practice. Do you know doctors are telling patients that they can't be in the practice unless they take one of the research vaccines? Doctors who do that are over the line. These doctors don't have an inch of maneuverability. At all. They can't look me in the eye. They are walking a line of shame. You know what's going on? Do you know why the reason why the doctors are pushing the vaccines on the patients? Because they are actually using patients as human shields. They are so afraid of the vaccine, so afraid of the virus, pushing the vaccine on patients. The same reason why teachers are pushing the vaccine on the students. It's the idea of using everyone else as a human shield. And I had a chance to be filmed in a documentary that's going to come out, and the producers from the UK, and I had a chance to meet with them, because they had already interviewed all the federal players that you see on TV, every one of them. So I had a chance to ask them, what do they really think? When they get on TV, the NIH directors, the CDC, FDA, what do they really think about the vaccines? And the answer is, they think the vaccines really don't work, unless every single person takes them. Over and over again. Everybody uses the other person as a human shield. That's what they believe. Now that makes sense. That means no regard for safety. None. It's driven out of fear. The fear is you could give it, somebody else could give it to you, so you better make sure there's a vaccine in them. A needle in every arm, the most important moniker of all time, a needle in every arm, over and over and over again, endless shots, endless. The medical freedom linked to social and economic freedom. You can't let the circle of medical freedom, as soon as you take a shot to travel or for school, you've actually allowed the body to be violated. The human body now has been violated by something you really didn't want. And to make matters worse, it looks like it's, for sure, it's genetic. And to make matters worse, it looks like it's long-acting. And to make matters worse, it produces a protein that was devised and manipulated in a lab in China. Everybody who's taken the vaccine has a dose of something from a lab in Wuhan, China. That is a horrible thought. That is a horrible thought. I can't think, honestly, of a worse thought. And they did it because they were told that their social school or work was on the line, and that's linked to economic freedom. This is the slipperiest slope we have ever seen human beings presented with, I think, in modern history. Public and private outrage over this. They're ineffective, unsafe, and they're forced. It couldn't be worse. This is not like forcing the meningococcal vaccine. Do you know we ask kids to take meningococcal vaccine before they go to college? There's zero deaths with that. Zero. If this was as safe as the meningococcal vaccine, we'd all go outside and just get a shot. Say, listen, let's get it over with. The reason why people don't want their vaccines is not because they're anti-vax. They don't want to lose their life. They don't want to have blood clots. They don't want to have heart inflammation. They don't want to end up paralyzed. And we can't tell from the next person whose number is going to get dialed up. Joe Rogan asked me, well, why is there 200 million people who took the vaccines and they're fine? I said, Joe, I'm glad for them. I'm glad for them that they're fine. But it's not okay to have a million people be injured and have thousands of people die. This isn't about the greater good. This is about having a safe product or get it off the market. There's been censorship. This is what Juan went over today. This is the Trusted News Initiative. It was announced by the BBC and all the major media that they were going to do this at the start of the vaccination program in December of 2020. They were going to do everything they could to promote the vaccines and anything to squelch vaccine hesitancy, meaning early treatment as an option, kill it. Anything on vaccine safety, kill it, and only wildly promote the vaccines. Everywhere you go on social media, it says take a vaccine, take a vaccine. Get more vaccine information. Vaccines are safe and effective. I went to the CDC website today, and all over the website, it said the vaccines are safe and effective without any support or without any discussion of the information I've given you tonight. Senator Ron Johnson is wonderful. He understands this. He's the one who's chaired now three sets of U.S. Senate testimony, actually four sets with the original ones on steroids. He's led the very first vaccine injury press conference. He's done two of them, and he's proposed legislation to give compensation and recognition to vaccine injuries. Ron Johnson is an American hero, and he sees things clearly. People say, well, Dr. McCullough, how come you're the only doctor who sees things this way? I'm not the only doctor. You know, there's a small group of doctors who have eyes to see, ears to hear. There's a small number of lawmakers, and he is one of them. Many have said that we're in a form of mass formation, okay? And it's been popularized now by Matthias Desmond, who has a book out called The Psychology of Totalitarianism, and by Mark McDonald, his book is United States of Fear. They both say the same thing. We've had a period of prolonged isolation. We've had things taken away from us that we enjoy to do. We've had constant free-floating anxiety. Do you know last night on the Bahamian news was a bunch of anxious reports from your public health officials about subvariants of Omicron, creating more fear? They said, well, we don't know if lockdowns are coming back to the island. Okay. And then the capper is, have the answer come from entities of authority. Now, this happened in the religious cult suicides. It happened in Nazi Germany. It happened as a form of contagious groupthink where people start thinking in bizarre ways that don't make sense. Everything I talked to you tonight, it doesn't make sense for cardiologists to give something that damages the heart. There's a million examples of things that don't make sense. What Matthias Desmond says is how we know we are in mass formation is when you see examples of absurdity absurdity. Lots of examples with masks, right? People in swimming pools wearing masks. People riding bikes outside. People driving alone wearing masks. It's absurd. Well, it's just absurd to take vaccines. Former President Obama, triple vaxxed. He gets COVID. What does he say? He says, good reminder to take a vax. It's like, no, that's absurd. The vax is supposed to stop COVID. It's not a good reminder. You can imagine, you get COVID, well, take a vaccine. Okay. You get COVID again, well, take another vaccine. You can imagine how absurd it is to take endless injections of genetic transfer technology for something that's effectively the common cold. There is absurdity to this. So what can we do? You know, I saw this early on. I saw the need for early treatment, and I saw issues with vaccine safety and efficacy. I've done everything I can in Senate testimony, state testimony, media. It's my first trip outside the United States in 2 years. I'm doing everything I can. I can tell you Dr. Archer Cartwright and the heroic doctors in this room are doing the same thing. And when I go on national TV, actually Laura Ingraham wanted me on tonight, and I told her I couldn't do it. You know, it's very clear. Look at the title. Mandate should be dropped across the board, urges Dr. McCullough. I'm not pulling any punches here. I'm not being too subtle. I'm just telling you, listen, these mandates don't have any place in a free and civil society. Going on Joe Rogan helped a lot, and I think I still have the distinction. I think I'm the record holder for the number of listens he's ever had. He normally gets about 10 million pretty smart young people listen to Joe Rogan, average age 24. I went on with him 4 weeks. He had 40 million. Nobody knew what was going on. What caused the 4X? And then Biden and Neil Young and Prince Harry and everything, everybody got involved and said, oh, Dr. McCullough, has said things that has created a lot of attention. Well, I showed Joe Rogan the slides I'll show you tonight. That's what we went over. That's what created all the buzz. And so when the backlash happened, about probably 20 more million people downloaded. So it even became more of interest. And then quickly people got off of me and said, well, Joe Rogan said racial comments, or Joe Rogan did this or that, and they took it on a personal attack. So Joe Rogan has subsequently brought in Robert Malone. He previously had Pierre Corey and Brett Weinstein. Now he's had Masheed Nawaz. So Joe Rogan is really, in a sense, he's become part of this as a very smart and successful journalist. Joe Rogan, by the way, has a much bigger audience than CNN or Fox or any of the news stations. We've had a very big march in Washington, January 23rd. One is coming up this weekend in L.A., in Los Angeles, Defeat the Mandates, American Homecoming. I had a chance to make a presentation on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. About 30,000 people marched from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial. It looked like this when I addressed the crowd here. It's really cold. But I stopped a couple times in my speech, and I listened for any counter-protest. Was anybody out there supporting the vaccines? You know, when there's a protest, there's always a counter-viewpoint. Nothing. Nothing. There wasn't a single person saying these vaccines were a good idea. Not a one. There wasn't any single heckler. This was an intelligent, perceptive audience. And it wasn't just me. It was other doctors. There were firefighters and nurses and police officers and leaders of faith. I mean, this was really a coming together over the issue of freedom. And Malone said it best where he said, listen, where there's risk, there must be choice. It's pretty clear the vaccines have risk. You don't have mandates here, but you effectively have mandates the way you have this kind of encouraged in your society. In the United States, we have mandates that is creating so much anxiety and so much discomfort. In Canada, it's worse. In Canada, as you probably recall, the truckers shut down Ottawa for a couple weeks, and we saw something we've never seen before. You know what the response was from the Canadian government? It wasn't discussion. It wasn't dialogue. It wasn't negotiation. They said, we're freezing your bank accounts. Take note of that. Take note of that. They are taking the liberty of now influencing people's personal possessions. In fact, in some people, their lifetime savings was put on the line. Take note of that. No discussion, no discourse, no resolution. About 20% of the truckers were Americans, by the way, about 80% Canadian. But that really showed us something. Now, we've had truckers now in Hagerstown, Maryland. They're going to be in L.A. this weekend. Let's see how much press we see on this. Our U.S. Senate hearings, we've done everything we could within the range of our laws to get the message to Americans, and I've been very involved in doing things the right way, being careful and responsible both in the media and Senate testimony. There I am next to Ron Johnson. That big back to us right now is Attorney Tom Renz. He was presenting the DMED data, the military. The military in 2021 has seen a multifold increase in blood clots, myocarditis, heart attacks, stroke, cancer, fetal loss. Our military, and this is a clinical occurrence system, this isn't self-report, but yet another piece of evidence that the vaccines are effectively wreaking havoc on the health of our military. If you want to learn more about what's behind all this, COVID-19 and the Global Predators, We Are the Prey, I think it's the best book out there, about 1,000 citations. It's nonfiction. I wrote one of the introductions. People always want to know, who's orchestrating all this? I said, I don't know, I'm just a doctor. Tucker Carlson asked me this. I said, I'm just a doctor. I'm focused on the next patient in front of you. But there's obviously a much bigger story out there of what's going on. So the connections between the U.S. National Institutes of Health, academic institutions, the EcoHealth Alliance, Gavi, CEPI, Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, the WHO, the Chinese Communist Party, the careful linkage of all of these, World Economic Forum. And one of the things that Bragan told me, he says, everything's in the open. Don't look for secret memos. When Klaus Schwab wrote the book, The Great COVID-19, as this wonderful opportunity for the World Economic Forum to basically create a new world order, and when Biden said that a month ago, take note, it's in the open. When Trudeau froze the bank accounts, take note of that. It's in the open, it's not concealed. There's something going on very, very big, and it's way bigger than COVID-19 alone. So to finish and conclude, COVID-19 pandemic is a global disaster. Its pathophysiology is complex. The doctors will recognize that. The pre-hospital phase is the therapeutic opportunity. Early ambulatory therapy with a sequence multi-drug regimen is supported by available sources of evidence, has a very positive benefit to risk ratio. It reduces the risk of hospitalization and death, and more safely temporizes for us to close the pandemic crisis. You know, I haven't prescribed hydroxychloroquine ivermectin in months because the nasal washes are so effective. I've got people on them right now as we talk. Now, the COVID-19 genetic vaccines have an unfavorable safety profile. The protection is not sufficient or complete or durable. The vaccine efficacy is way below 50% now. The virus has mutated beyond the reach of the vaccines. Censorship and reprisal are working to crush freedom of speech and scientific discourse. If we can't talk like this, we're never going to make any medical progress. It's very, very important to understand that. This is a sacred privilege. I have this painting now from Janie Elson, Independent, Kansas, that basically shows that we're in a sense like the angel. We have weighed out things tonight. We've tried to, you know, exercise discernment. We need to be, in a sense, like the lion. We need to emanate truth. St. Augustine said, the truth is like a lion. Let it out. It can defend itself. I told Joe Rogan, listen, I'm not afraid. The truth is so clear, no one has the power to handle it on the other side. And what lays in the background for us is the United States, and here is the wonderful country, the island nation, archipelago of the Bahamas. So the call to action, in my view, I'll be very clear about this, we need to, in the United States, drop all these vaccine mandates, prohibit all forms of pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal for vaccination. Whether or not someone took the vaccine is their own decision. That is a privileged, protected health information. It's not up for public inquiry. We need to ban all forms of vaccine discrimination. In my view, we need to pause and take off the market Pfizer, Moderna, J&J. We just don't have enough good news. Novavax is out there. I think we still need more evaluation on it, but I think the genetic vaccines, and here I throw in there AstraZeneca, needs to go off the market. Begin vaccine injury treatment centers at major medical centers. We need to have a ton of research poured into vaccine injuries, and we need a nationwide pivot, a countrywide pivot to early treatment, and that let's not have another single life lost or another hospitalization that doesn't even happen. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you.
I know you can do better than that. That is wow.
Thank you.
Wow. That is real, serious food. And if we are going to sit tight and allow ourselves to continually be manipulated and lied to, when, like Dr. McCullough said, it's all out in the open. They're not even hiding it. The information is freely available for us to interrogate for ourselves and to decide for ourselves the way forward. At this time, we're going to open the floor to questions. We have a mic set up in the center aisle, but while you're coming to the aisle, you start forming lines behind the microphone. But I just want to say to Dr. McCullough, we're going to have a more formal word of thanks, but I want to say thank you so much for your effort, for your strength, your willingness, as we say locally, your gumption, which means your tenacity. All right, so
bold and relentless is what I usually text back, because I get these messages. By the way, the countries that are hurting the most are Australia and New Zealand.
Yes.
And well, you know, probably about half of my emails are these they're desperate.
Yes.
And they're doing it to themselves. Australia has 12 vaccine concentration camps. Two of them are open, and they're marching themselves into these concentration camps. And it's just, they can't understand what they're doing to themselves. They have hardly any COVID.
Not at all.
So, okay, their lights are really bright, but go ahead, doctor, go ahead.
All right, first question.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. McCullough. I have to say I'm in a bit of a shock. So we've been always told that these vaccines are safe, effective, and that there are no early treatments. And what you've shown us tonight is a completely different narrative. And I've been listening to you carefully over the last 4 days, and you've been also telling us about the things, the truths that they've been withholding from us. When I brought up my children, I told them, "Tell the truth, it's a lie." And so they didn't tell us about the risk stratification that you referred to, that children with old people with comorbidities were much more likely to succumb to the disease. They didn't tell us that the average age for death from COVID in the UK was 82.5 years and 78 in the US. How many of us, if we'd known that information, would have taken the shot? They didn't tell us about the absolute risk reduction. They told us about relative risk reduction, which was at 90%, and then it went down to 50%, but actually the absolute risk reduction was less than 1% for that whole trial population. If they had told us that, how many of us would have taken a vaccine? They lied about natural immunity. That is the most shocking thing, that once you got COVID and recovered, you had a much higher level of protection than vaccine-induced immunity. They knew that, but they didn't tell. They've been denying that for quite some time. And then the whole herd immunity thing, that, you know, they, again, ignored the fact that if you recover from COVID, you were part of the herd. We didn't even know that. They just told us to get vaccinated. And so I found that very shocking. And then just take the vaccine, and not only that, they then didn't tell us that the vaccines were non-sterilizing, as you said in your presentation, which means they only treated symptoms of the disease, but did not sterilize the virus, SARS-CoV-2. Had we known all of those things, how many of us would have then gone and got that shot? So saying all that, I've got questions for you. There's two questions in one.
By the way, that was a really good summary, and you brought up some points that I just didn't have time to make, so thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I can't compete with you. Two questions, because my friends are coming up to me and saying, "Mark, you know, we're actually guinea pigs. We're still in a research phase for the next year." I'm saying that can't be true, so I'd like to know if that's the fact. Also,
let me just take that at first.
Yes.
So all the vaccines are still under emergency use all over the world, and so the consent forms, look at them carefully, they all say investigational or research or not fully approved. When the vaccines get fully approved, you'll know it because the consent forms will change, and then each person will be given a package insert that will list all these safety things. The people who take the vaccines right now are not getting the listing of these thousands and thousands of side effects. But they will have to produce those in a package insert. That's how you know the vaccines are not fully FDA approved. There's a false talking point that even the President of the United States said that Pfizer was fully approved. And obviously it's not, because nothing's changed. There's still a government program. The products are not bought and sold, and there's no package insert. And because of that, they are still investigational, meaning that you also agree to tracking. When you take the vaccine, you are now somebody who is trackable. They actually know who you are because you're a research subject.
Wow. I didn't know that. Well, the other question I have is, you know, people are saying, are these actually vaccines? And I noticed that the CDC changed their definition of vaccine not just once, but twice to accommodate these products. So are they technically vaccines, or are they something else? Because Robert Malone said they're gene therapy.
No, they are officially classified as gene transfer technology or